for how words are put together, what makes something literary as opposed to not. And the same thing with architecture. You cannot do architecture. I mean, I defy any student to come in here and in the first year know what to do if design, you know, to design a house, because you know, you all know what a house is, but so what does it look like? Why does it look like? Does it have a pitched roof? Does it have a flat roof? Is it two stories, one story? You have no capacity to make those decisions architecturally. And so what I'm trying to do is to give you some strategies for operating. Now, for example, a lot of people, you try to use classical architecture, motifs from classical architecture, yet they use modern plans. In other words, they use columnar plans, and they don't use poche. They don't use the structure as poche to define the void space. The void space is like a Corbu free plan. We're going to see what a free plan looks like by the end of the term. So these people that are purporting to do classical architecture don't really do classical architecture because they don't understand the role of poche or the lack of it in a plan. You cannot have a classical plan that doesn't have a certain type of poche. You cannot have a modern plan, let's say, that in fact has poche. If there to be a, if in other words, if you say, I want to do a modern plan for whatever. So what you have to do is to understand the role of the solid and the void, the structure and the space, the facade, the interior and the exterior, in relationship to one another. And these are the things that every week we're sort of adding to the disciplinary knowledge that you have. All right? Now, last week we did Brunelleschi. We did the first, as it were, animation of the subject. That is, the subject becomes an active participant in the space. The space is organized so that a sentient, seeing subject can understand the organization and what is intended for. Both spaces, San Lorenzo and Santo Spirito, are organized in a similar but different way, so that the subject is made conscious that through seeing, he or she can understand those differences. It, in fact, those buildings thematize what I've been calling opticality. What we're going to find in the third year here, in, let's say, my studio and other studios, is that opticality is one of the problems that architects today are trying to get away from. But in the 15th and 16th century, they were thematizing it because it thematized the subject. Now, what does Alberti do? Alberti brings in two things. One is the concept of the sign, that is representation, and the other is a critique of Vitruvius's idea of structure. And what he says is that structure is not merely structure, but must look like structure. And so why that's a real issue in the work that we will be looking at in Alberti is because today there has been a shift from the mechanical paradigm, i.e. where the thematic issue was, does something look like it's holding something up, that is, resisting the forces of gravity. We have had a major paradigmatic shift from the mechanical paradigm to the electronic. And no longer do we need to thematize holding something up. That is, looking like holding something up. So again, there is a critique of a critique necessary today, because within the mechanical paradigm, Alberti's critique of Vitruvius was appropriate. Today, to make the same critique of Vitruvius would not be appropriate. Instead, it would be appropriate to make a critique of Alberti. So, to make a critique of Alberti, you first have to know what he did and what he said. So what Alberti did was to suggest that a column looked like a column, and it looked like it holds something up. But he also did another thing, and that was he introduced the idea of representation from history. And what Alberti said in Della Pittura on painting, that storia, or history, is the most important phenomenon for an art. That is, to establish its disciplinary thematics over time. And while art history had this, in other words, we showed the evolution of art as a thematic condition for from a sort of flattened condition of figures which were illustrative to real figures, having real faces, real bodies, having real shades and shadows, having a certain light which affected the coloration of the robes, having a perspectival condition in depth to show space in relationship to figuration. All of these things were part of the evolutionary history of painting and sculpture. But architecture never had such a history. And so what Alberti said is we've got to begin to understand architectural history. We've got to go back, I mean, in other words, a conscious, thematized history. And so he went back to Roman times and Greek times and suggested that we can use those artifacts not merely as structures but as signs of classical moments in architecture, signs of a thematic condition of the subject, where the subject had a conscious role prior to the Middle Ages and the Dark Ages and prior to the Renaissance. And so what he did was to take for his facade at San Andrea two elements. One, the Greek temple front, which had become a traditional element to signify the sacred space, and he took the Arch of Titus, which was a symbol of man's domination of man, and he collaged them together so that neither one of them would have their former meaning, but they would have a new meaning as a church facade at San Andrea. Another thing that he did, which was unique and what you were drawing today, was that he took that church facade and instead of saying there's a facade and then there's an interior nave and narthex and apse, he said that the facade continued from inside to outside, so that the side facades of San Andrea interior, not exterior, are the same as the front facade. So this is, yeah.
I understand that that he's using the Greek temple and the Arch of Constantine to historic
yeah.
purposes. But what is that purpose? What's the message of taking those and mixing them together and plastering them on as the facade?
Well, they were, the message as far as what they were intended to do was to move the thematic from man's relationship to God, let's say, as sacred symbolism, to the idea of the domination of man, because the Greek temple front was, first of all, pagan, and it had become vernacular. In other words, it had become merely what one would call a symbol, that is, an agreed-upon conventional group of architectural elements that signified something, okay? But it had nothing to do with the transcendent notion of a greater being. It was now vernacular pagan, right? The Arch of Titus, or the Arch of Constantine, either one, had symbolic meaning not to God, but man's superiority over man. In other words, the thematic of man. And so what Alberti did was to take these two, the sacred and the profane, the dominance of man and the absence of God, puts them together to suggest man's new centric position in the cosmology. Okay? It is clear as I can make it. So that we now have a facade that has a series of iconic or symbolic elements that come from the past, from other architectures, right? From other contexts, brought together to make a church facade, one that had never been seen like that before. Okay, so now we have, one, the bringing of something from history, which instantiates in the present a past, a history of architecture. Number two, we have a new method, a new strategy of implementation, that is collage, taking two different things from two different contexts, placing them over one another. But the third thing, and one of the most important things architectonically, is the fact that the inside facades and the outside facades are the same thing. So therefore, there becomes an inside-outside correlation which never existed before. That is, a facade was a facade, something on the outside of a Romanesque church, a Greek temple, what have you. Never before in the history of architecture was the facade repeated on the inside. So now we have the possibility of an inside-outside relationship, that the outside is the inside is the outside. Now, this is something that modern architecture will take up again. Collage is something that modern architecture will take up again. So it is clear to me that those people who did these, worked with collage, worked with the dialogue between inside and outside, knew San Andrea. And San Andrea is a pivotal church. There's no question that it suggests many energies. Now we're going to see, hopefully, as I think San Lorenzo and Santo Spirito are pivotal churches, next week when we look at the courtyard of Santa Maria della Pace, we look at Bramante's different schemes for St. Peter's, we're going to realize that already this history has accumulated to such a degree, let's say, that Bramante wants to reduce that history. So we have a build-up from the Gothic to the early Renaissance in Brunelleschi, a further build-up in Alberti, and then Bramante radically trying to change the conditions that he found himself in, tried to reduce the impact of what he was doing to a degree zero. And we have the same idea in Roland Barthes' writing Degree Zero, which was part of the new structuralism that happened in the 60s in France especially, but throughout philosophy. And what we find in Bramante is an attempt to reduce 100 years of history to a zero point, to a restarting, to a beginning again of the relationship of form and space, space and time, subject to object, etc. Right. We will look at that next week. But you should be aware of that when you're drawing the different Pochés. What was Bramante trying to do through Poche to move architecture away from the direction that was set up by Alberti? Okay. So we're going to look at some pics of, I think you have the Alberti, is that correct? Okay. Let's look at some pics and see what we got. So here we have the famous facade of the Palazzo Ruccellai. Now, one of the things that's important, to, this is in Florence. When you go to Florence, it's something you should see. But one of the important issues in Florentine Palazzi and the evolution of the Renaissance Palazzo in Florence was the notion of rustication. And that there were usually three-story, a ground floor, a piano nobile, and an upper story. And usually there is a heavy rustication at the base, a lesser rustication halfway up, and an even lesser rustication on the top story. Now, what you will see here is a very different idea of rustication. First of all, there's very little difference in the rustication between this story, and this story, so that the rustication is not progressive. It, in fact, if anything, if you look at the drawing, the rustication seems heavier up here than it is down here. But in a sense, you have what is called a flattened rustication. Now, there is a reason for that. And the reason for that is the presence of these flattened pilasters, which are looking like columns, right? And you see the lintel here, so that you have an entablature and the columns. You have what is called, as you know, post and beam construction. So, what you have is an attempt to show two structural systems, but not too much. In other words, you can't have the rustication overwhelming the columns, or the columns overwhelming the rustication, i.e. the rustication cannot be too heavy so that one says this is a rusticated building, or that the columns cannot be too heavy so that one says it's a columnar building. The idea that the columns are thin and paper thin and the stone appears paper thin shows you that what you're trying to do is to reduce the structural nature to look at the sign quality, so that the literal real stone or the literal real column are reduced, in fact, to a kind of very thin condition. And there you have the two possibilities. One, that it is a columnar building with panelized stone filled in, or else it is a rusticated wall-bearing building with the columns added. So this is the first time, again, in the history of architecture where we have a dialectic between two systems, two structural systems, a post and beam system and a wall system. And in fact, either one of them could do. Now, the fact that either one of them could do gives you the following reading options. One, the columns are structural, the walls are not. Two, the walls are structural, the columns are not. Or, the walls are 50% structural and the columns are 50% structural. Anything less than full structure means that what you're looking at are the signs of structure. In other words, the doubling of a system, the redundancy of the system, makes for the idea of a sign. Because if it's not acting as structure, what is it acting at? Why is it there? This was an idea, and having studied the Palazzo Ruccellai way back in my course at Cornell, was an idea that I used in my house too, where I did the same thing, a different genre and style, but in fact used a columnar system and a wall-bearing system that could operate equally to show, in fact, that they were signs. So this is a strategy of when you're trying to articulate, let's say, or as Alberti was, the question of representation, the question that something wasn't really what it was, but also looked like what it was. In other words, a conscious something plus looking like the something. That we call an immanent metaphysic. In other words, the thing itself, that is the physical, plus the thing that looks like something, metaphysical, plus immanent, that is within the thing itself, as opposed to a transcendent metaphysic, that is relating to an higher authority, i.e. to a God. So here we have a real example of the early and high Renaissance's idea of the transition from a transcendent metaphysic to an immanent metaphysic, where the conditions of consciousness between the subject and object rely only on the object and the subject and not some higher order of being. And that's a really important shift that we're still with. In other words, one of the problematics of today, in addition to opticality, and we'll hear this over and over again, is how do we get out of the way of an immanent metaphysic? And of course, if we all knew what that was, at least I, for one, wouldn't be sitting here telling you about it. It's one of the real issues that sculpture, painting, and architecture are dealing with, have been dealing with in the last 50 years.
Peter, right?
Mm-hmm.
When you took that idea in House 2, was the columnar system able to carry 100% of the
Yes.
weight, and a wall bearing able to
Yes.
carry 100%?
Yes.
So they could have done without each other.
They were absolutely duplicated.
But they were superimposed on top of
them. No, they were 4 feet apart.
Okay.
They were 12-foot bays, 4 feet apart, so you had 4 and 8. But a 12-foot columnar bay would have, steel would support the thing, and walls 12 feet of bearing walls that were 1.5 foot thick would also support the system. But it was precisely coming out of the Palazzo Rucellai. And that, for me, was, you know, one of the things that one was trying to understand. Okay, next, please. This is the detail of the door, and one of the interesting things that you're going to find in as we move forward past Bramante to Palladio and Serlio and others, Giulio Romano, is the question of the panel. Okay? Now, the frame. Remember we talked about frames in the painting? Well, we now have frames within frames, which are really interesting. I mean, here, the pilasters are framing a panel, right? And within the panel is another panel framed within it. And here there is, you know, a very interesting frame, very articulated outboard frame, what you would call the passepartout. In other words, if you're taking traditional framing and painting, you have the actual canvas, you have the frame, and then you have the paper that's between it that frames the painting, which is called the passepartout. So here we have a frame, a passepartout, and an empty frame. Now, this is one of what I would call the tropes of the Renaissance, where you begin to frame voids. That voids start to take on positive characteristics, and then because of the depth here in the shadow, this becomes the operative figure here, this passepartout in the frame, as opposed to the stones, which become the background. So that which was formerly panel here becomes the ground to something which is a figure here, and the figure is a void. Now, if we shift 400 years forward, Le Corbusier, one of Le Corbusier's first and most famous, or several of his famous buildings, the Villa Schwab, and the cinema at Le Chaux de Fonds. The thematic of the facade is an empty frame. Okay? So it moves from the 15th century and 16th century directly to the 20th century. And what one is supposed to get when one looks at the Villa Schwab, let's say, or the cinema at Le Chaux de Fonds, and you say, boy, that's a dumb facade. Look at that blank panel in the center. The whole center has nothing animating it. You're supposed to get a recall, the same kind of recall that Marcel Proust talks about in Remembrance of Things Past, when the person is walking on the Megalese Way and the footsteps on the stones, and he instantly recalls the same feeling of the cobbles under his feet and the sound of his feet on the cobbles in the Piazza San Marco. And so there's a certain, what one would call frisson, attendant to reading about the man understanding the past in the present. Corbeau does the same thing. He wants you, when you see the Villa Schwab and the theater at Le Chaux de Fonds, to recall this kind of thing, to recall the blank canvas in the framed frame of nothing, where nothing becomes something. And therefore, when you look at Le Chaux de Fonds or Villa Schwab, you are to get that sense of frisson of the past in the present. The only way you could get that is to be able to understand and see this kind of thing. And, you know, Corbeau plays off many of these Renaissance tropes. There's nothing new. He merely places them in a different context. And we have architects today like Rem Koolhaas and Jacques Herzog doing riffs on Le Corbusier. And so it brings you very close to the present when you realize, when you see a blank facade. So I think it's very important to realize that many of the things that happen in these situations are repeated again in history. We have the next, please. Yeah, excuse me, go ahead.
On the last slide, the rhythm...
The next back?
Yeah. The rhythm of the brickwork, particularly on the first floor...
Let's go back, we need to...
No, this one here.
This one, okay. Yeah. This guy?
Yeah.
The rhythm...
The rhythm that Alberti uses of the brickwork,
yeah,
particularly on the first floor. Is that also some kind of reference to an architecture where you have a much more, a heavier... We're using stone as opposed to panel?
Well, what's interesting is if you look at the stonework on the... Let's go back one. I didn't go into it. But the rhythm, by the way, is very different because this rhythm is a kind of even rhythm of flattened stones, bricks, units, right? But over here, down below, you have a very different rhythm. You have flat, flat, thick, flat, thick, flat, flat, thick, flat, thick, thick, and there's a different kind of alternation. I have no theoretical explanation for it. I think it's worthwhile noting. You can say it's because there's some latent rustication here. I mean, you can read anything you want. In other words, I'm not suggesting that my reading is the only reading. What I think is useful is for you to notice that and say, hey, could that be some latent rustication because he's got still big stones? Yes, it could be, right? There could be another explanation in terms of the alternation of these heavy stones with a kind of banding across the facade. If you look at this banding here, and you go to Jim Sterling, another modern architect who taught here not that many years ago, Wissenschaftszentrum in Berlin, you will notice a banding on the facade very similar to this. If you look at his Stuttgart Museum that he did, there's a banding on the facade of the rustication, very similar to the Palazzo Rucellai. So this alternating banding, okay? So we could spend 4 weeks doing nothing but looking at the different stone coursing from Alberti, Bramante, Raphael, Sangallo, etc., to see the different stone bandings and what their significance were, what their value other than structure was. In other words, what were they the sign of, right? A certain kind of horizontal spatial continuity, a play between vertical and horizontal. But there are many of these particular issues that we could turn to. The corners of buildings, the interior corners of buildings, the exterior corners of buildings, all have to do with the discipline of architecture. And certainly this facade suggests many lessons which I think are very important. Next, please. That's good, but next, yeah. Okay, now, one of the tropes that you're going to notice in as we go forward is the notion of the broken pediment, right? That is a trope of architecture that occurs beginning, I think, and I wouldn't say altogether certain of this, beginning with Alberti and San Sebastiano. And what it does is to show you that here is the colonnade, here is the pediment, here, the frieze and architrave, etc. And what it appears to be, two things happening, two kinds of dynamic energies happening on this facade. One is a kind of thrusting up, and we notice the location of this window breaking through the pediment, thrusting into a secondary arch on the interior of the pediment. And a second opposing energy is so that the void facade here thrusts up at the same time as the pediment is trying to contain itself as whole, compresses onto this window here. In a sense, there's a compressive energy, so that both the facade and the pediment take on animate characteristics, in other words, of thrusting up, of closing, etc. And they add internally to an internal, as it were, dynamic. In other words, it's not literally thrusting up, but we recall all pediments are continuous in history. So to see this, we realize we call it broken. We don't just say, oh, that's the natural situation of a pediment. So what this says is that we immediately recall the history of unbroken pediments when we look at this. And not only do we recall that history, but we say this is a broken pediment as opposed to a binuclear pediment, a two-part pediment. It's broken. And then we notice the reverse condition of this compression, which doesn't exist in any pediments prior to this, but we realize that other pediments have no energy, but this one looks to be trying to close in on the window, so it has a compressive energy. And therefore, we begin to read in relationship to what we know, and things take on characteristics, animate, dynamic, morphological characteristics in relationship to precedent. And so the important thing is to know the precedent, and to know the sort of aberrant conditions from precedent. Now, you're going to find thousands of these things, and we're going to see very sophisticated ones when we get to Borromini and Carlo Rinaldi and Palladio, playing off of this game of the broken pediment, okay? So Alberti opens up a whole raft of architectural possibilities playing off of what were thought to be normal conditions prior. Here is the actual San Sebastiano built, and you see it's a little bit different from this drawing, but it still has this thrusting up of the center through the architrave and frieze. It has, instead of this giant staircase, two side staircases, but this is clearly an important facade. Notice what's missing. The columns are missing, and there is this flattened condition. There is a column at the corner, which articulates the corner. It's a very strange condition of a flattened column here, which is held up by another very much thinner column over here, and therefore a very strange flattening in this story here, a elongation in this story, a compression in this story, and a release up here. So you have all the way up through the facade different elemental pieces that don't align with the piece below. And in other words, that take on the pieces, the engaged columns here, pilasters here, the flattened pilasters here relate to this. These relate internally here. Then you get the window here, the arch here, all of a different sequence. And so therefore it's possible to think as a series of layers that go up, that are next to one another, that are contiguous, but not architecturally contiguous. They are different, yeah.
At this point, does the facade still act as a sign, or has it manipulated it so much that it's broken free from its reference?
I think there's very little sign function on the facade. In other words, I'll get just a minute. I think it's a very good question. What the conditions here when you say sign, there are two kinds of signs. Signs that refer outward to precedent, to other conditions, and signs that refer inward. So for me, these are inward referencing signs. In other words, they refer to the compositional structure of the facade that is here as opposed to other facades. Yes, question.
Why are the
tender
zoning
that was drawn? Oh, I don't know. A lot of times, I'll tell you what. First of all, let me analyze the question. It's a good question. There are several reasons that could be. One, a change of the strategy on the part of the architect. Two, a change of the strategy of part of the client. Whatever. I mean, many times we draw buildings that are built because the contractor, for budget reasons or whatever, are different. We're right now, I just came back from Spain yesterday, we're building six buildings in a cultural complex. Two of them we drew a certain way, and the new owners decided they're going to change the functions. So, you know, 100 years from now, somebody's going to say, hey, why'd they build it differently? Nothing to do necessarily with the architecture. Palladio, which is very interesting to me, and we'll see this in Palladio, at the end of his life, 10 years before he died, he redrew all of his buildings. He first drew them once, they built them, and then he redrew them, not as they were built or as he had initially drawn them, but as he intended them to be remembered. And therefore the drawing of Palladio is the more accurate record of Palladio's intentions as opposed to the way the buildings were built. So that Palladio was aware that many times people built things in ways that were not drawn. I mean, I can take you to any number of buildings and show you a drawing and say it's not built that way. If you get the contractor to understand 80% of a drawing, I don't care if it's in the 15th century, 16th century, today, you're lucky. I mean, I was looking at some things and I said, hey guys, you know, this isn't the way we drew it. And they said, yeah, we know. And I said, yeah, but that's not the way, the intention. You can't read what I was trying to draw. And they said, yeah, what do you want us to do? Well, sometimes you want them to rip it out. Other times you say, okay, I'll give you this one, but the next one you got to give me. There's all of this horse trading. Contractors are no more agile at reading drawings than architects are at building. Okay, so oftentimes drawings are a source of great information. Sometimes the buildings are. If you said to me, why are these different? I couldn't tell you why they're different. In other words, but it's not an issue for this particular class. It's probably an issue for Renaissance Alberti. I happen to be an architect, not an historian. So, but I'm certain that there is some treatise written about San Sebastiano. I mean, some PhD art historian in 1914 studied the relationship between the facade of San Sebastiano and the actual building. And there are probably archival records in museums and libraries, the bibliothecas of Rome, that would give you the answer to those questions. I don't think they're really important here. I'll tell you an interesting story. I took a course in Gothic architecture at Columbia when I was a graduate student under one of the great masters of Gothic architecture, Robert Branner. And I won a Fulbright Fellowship to go to France to study the fourth nave bay this is me as an architect, this is a hard story to believe. The fourth nave bay at Chartres Cathedral, why was it sinking? That's how I won my Fulbright, right? And I got to France and I said, this is really a bunch of junk. I don't give a damn why the fourth nave bay at Chartres Cathedral is sinking. I'm an architect. What am I doing? I mean, I made up this cockamamie story to get a Fulbright, and now that I'm here, I don't want to be here. I don't want to do this for a year, and I wouldn't be able to figure it out anyway, right? So I fled France and went to Cambridge, which was a great change in my life. I gave up my Fulbright, and I began to study architecture, not to study art history. And there's an enormous difference. And believe me, if I said to you, okay, for your term paper, would you please find out the difference between this and this, I would be sending you off on a goose chase which would have very little relevance to your career as an architect. Yeah?
But if you're looking at how architecture is a continuum and how it responds to the building's prior, isn't it important to look at the physical structure as
Yeah, I said that. Sometimes the drawings have the intentions better than the buildings, right? But if you said to me, is it important in this class to know what this intention is as opposed to this intention as built? Number one, I couldn't answer the question, and number two, I don't think it's very relevant, but if it's really something that excites you, go for it, right? I mean, it's like saying, if somebody said to me, Peter, could you tell me what kind of stone that is and how does it weather? And why did it weather like this? And, you know, were there originally paintings designed? I mean, there could be lots of answers. I'm giving you what you need to know. I want you to keep your eye on the ball, all right? And don't let the ball roll off the table. And you'll know when I've got you on, when you've sort of focused on trivia, right? and when we'll look at your drawings inside, I'll see whether you've got the eye on the ball, right? What I don't want you to do is to get distracted from things and say, here's a drawing, here's that, why is it different? I don't know. Someone might know, but it's pure conjecture. But I could ask you to write a 7-page paper, why is it different, right? It's more interesting to know why the poche in Bramante's St. Peter's 1, 2, and 3 is different. That's a real architectural question. I don't believe the difference between the drawing and the facade is, in this terms, an architectural question. But I appreciate the question. Next. These are analytic studies of the facade of San Sebastiano, and to showing you how proportionally these things, these harmonic proportions, how everything worked with squares and a golden section, rectangles, and how the harmonics of the ear were translated to the harmonics of the eye. Now, I think this is a very revelatory drawing in the sense that it shows you what you were looking at is not mere happenstance, but a result of some calculation. Whether this is not Alberti's drawing, whether he ever drew it like this or not, he had an innate sense of proportions to be able to, in fact, you know, produce something like that. It has quite an extraordinary set of proportional relationships. And of course, I mean, the real key is, here is the center line, which is the ground line of, you know, the piano nobile of this circle. And if you take the circle around, it hits the top of this arch here, which is, you know, quite extraordinary. And of course, if you, you know, lift these circles up, you get the relationship between this edge, the top. And, you know, you can go through and make these kinds of proportional drawings, you know, ad infinitum. But they merely relate architecture to what I would call a stable Platonic geometry that is of certain proportions. What I'm interested is in the instability that also exists. And I could draw you another drawing that would mark the instabilities on this facade rather than its stabilities. And I think, you know, that's an important thing. For example, if you compare the frieze architrave relationship here to the height of the pediment, you'll find that this is extraordinarily thick compared to any classical condition. And so there is a dimension here which is out of scale with the height of the pediment. These are the kinds of things that I look for, not the kind of stable things, but the unstable things as precedents of instability moving forward in history. Next, please. Now, what's interesting is this is the crypt plan, and of course, what I want you to look at is how seemingly different the crypt is from what you saw in the front. And what is important, and I want you to begin to notice, is the poche, all right? How the poche grabs onto the columns, and you get the sense that the space is cut away from the solid, this indentation here to articulate the proto-column or the engaged column or the column that's embedded in the poche, that the poche is a kind of active mass. It's not just static, but something that creeps around and is cut into by these pieces here. It's kind of molten stuff that this grid of columns. So it's not just a grid of columns that forms the space, which is important, but what's important is this thinning and thickening of this bounding condition, which is the poche. I think it's very important when you look at the crypt plan to realize that it isn't just this thin line, boom, 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 which continues all the way around as a single continuum, but more like this thinning and thickening poche. That is an active condition between the solid and the void. And that's why I show you that plan. Let's go next. This is the Tempio Malatestiana, also by Alberti, and we notice the broken pediment, although done differently because here the architrave comes across, and we don't know if there was going to be here an enclosure, a pedimental enclosure. But what's interesting about this break is that it's a break in depth, that you have a plane here and then the pediment continues behind, as if now not the thrust up but back. So the animation is from the forward plane back to the interior. And then again, an elongated nave. The side chapels sort of flattened and compressed have become, for me, you know, it's a very unique plan. We could, again, spend days on. Notice the articulation here, double, double, avoid, single, single, void, double, double. The way the articulation happens here, which creates a kind of striation across the plan of actual voids, indented voids, positive, so you could do a layering across the space, which would be quite interesting as a kind of analysis. Okay, that brings us to San Andrea, so let's take a 10-minute break and we continue. So listen, you heard what I told them. Any questions about the material so far today? More other questions? I mean, what I'm really interested in your doing is getting the thread of what I'm trying to present to you. And there is a thread that runs through. This is the fourth lecture. I really want very much for you to be able to get the idea, because if you got the idea, you'll get how to draw. And if you don't get the idea, you'll be just drawing illustrations without the ideas. And the whole thing is to relate what you see to what is given, to an idea that you might be able to have about the difference. That's the important thing. Not, I don't care. Why did Bramante do that difference? Why did he do the second plan different than the first? I don't know what Bramante thought, right? Who cares? There's a plan two, plan one, plan three. They're different. They're different architecturally. What was it about the muse of architecture that caused Bramante to feel something vibrating in his hand that caused him to draw it differently? Draw that vibration, right? Not what Bramante thought, but what you see. And that's really important. And that's really, for me, an important condition of what architecture is about. Now, here we have the Greek temple front, the classical pediment, the columns, and we have at the same time the triumphal arch. And here is the triumphal arch, or you can say this is the triumphal arch, any way you want to look at it. Certainly a triumphal arch with a pediment. But another important addition is this thrust of this piece here. And so what you get is again, a kind of thrusting that's behind. And it's as if there's something in this cutout here that pushes up underneath, producing this thrusting piece, which allows the triumphal arch and the Greek temple front to continue, but appears behind. Now, what Alberti did, which is important to understand, and you see there are no facades, there's a facade that goes around the corner here. What Alberti did, which is again a very new thing and a different thing, is that he pretended that this context, this stuff around the building, was here before the building, and the building was cut out of the context. What he really did was build a church and then built this kind of stuff around it, sort of indigenous material around it, to make it look like this material was here and the church was found and cut out of this exterior. Now, in other words, faking a kind of historical precedent for the church existing before the context. Now, what's interesting is that this whole motif of the tripartite facade, the flattened columns, is going to be repeated on the interior. And of course, you can see in terms of these side arches, a very, and they are continuous, by the way, very much similar to like San Sebastiano. They don't have capitals. They are a continuous, almost a stripped down Romanesque arch. Echoes in the proportions here of San Sebastiano. So that's, I think, an important issue to note. Next. We have in these drawings, one by Filippo Lippi on the right, and also the other by Domenico Veneziana on the left, drawings of architecture that start to suggest a relationship of the interior to what we were talking about on the facade. You begin to see niches, half-round domes here, a kind of perspectival condition where there is an apse piece here that extends out, and a kind of continuity of surface. And the whole notion of the continuity of surface, which first is seen, by the way, in Santo Spirito of Brunelleschi, you have the continuity of surface in these paintings, similar to the kind of continuity that you're going to see in San Andrea, only the continuity in San Andrea is one of a series of panels, that is an ABA relationship, as opposed to in Santo Spirito, a continuous AAA relationship. Next, please. And I only show you these paintings. This is Mantegna on the left and Malazzo da Forli on the right. The kinds of paneling that occurs in the arches, and notice how very similar this painting is, very similar to the idea of San Andrea in Mantua. Now, these paintings exist, both of them existed before the church at San Andrea. These are from, one is from Padua and one is from Rome. It's quite possible that these issues of the continuation of the side and the front are in the air, but they're certainly in the painting before they're in the architecture. In other words, you see evidence of this architectural detail that comes before San Andrea, which is the first evidence of this kind of detail. Next, please. And again, you have, this is Bellini on the left, and a Florentine engraving on the right. This tripartite giant art, a giant order here, a giant cut in which is what is not a pediment, but similar to the cut that we saw at San Sebastiano. Blank walls, and a kind of the architecture of the interior as a kind of arcaded interior space playing off these massive brute walls. And here you get a totally articulated, columnated space, which is no longer, it's tripartite. The center space is actually seems compressed. This arch seems deeper than these flattened arches here. They are all round and continuous, and they show a kind of arcuated, what post and beams space, which has nothing to do with Gothic structure. And all you have to do is compare these kinds of architectural inscriptions in painting with the earlier ones that we looked at, the perspectival ones, to realize that with the whole idea of architecture, its structure had changed from Gothic structure to a more panelized, gridded, more what I would call Platonic rationalism of Greek sensibility, as opposed to Gothic entering into the structures. Next, please. So here we have the plan of San Andrea, the interior of San Andrea, and what you realize, again, is you are having now a clearly striated plan, a plan where there is a compression. You can read this dimension as a compression of this here. And so there are these sausage-like horizontal bands that are taken up in the side facade that relate the spaces as in a series of compressions. And you have to look at the poche, because the poche is what gives this its energy. The niches here, which separate what would be a column from an extension of a side wall, the columns becoming both columns and pilasters, the column being articulated here, the pilaster on the side, the sort of porch entry here. Here is the facade. So this is the barrel vault, the dimension of the barrel vault. We have here a porch. So you have always now a kind of gasket of space between the exterior here, the plaza, and we're in a kind of porch here before we enter, or what would be called a narthex in a Gothic cathedral. We have this space of transition, and then we have a further transition articulated by the poche here till we get into the rhythm of A, B, C, B, A, B, C, etc. Until we get down to another poche and another kind of articulation and a further kind of poche in the apsand, the transepts. And what's interesting is many people have made models of the void space and the articulation of the void space. And here, the void is still dominant. In other words, you can read the void as dominant. What's going to happen in St. Peter's, and be careful of, is there's an equivalence between poche and space. That as the space has become invaded by the poche, so it's not clear dialectically which one is dominant, which one is recessive. And what you have clearly is, in most buildings, the space is the ground and the poche is the figure. What happens in St. Peter's, the poche starts to become the ground and the space the figure. So there's a shift toward a condition where space is the figural condition, that is the ground becoming figure. And that's an important issue that I want you to be aware of next week. Next, please. Here you have this worm's eye axonometric, which gives you the sense of the repetitive nature of the facade on the side chapels, the great barrel vault here, the crossing, the barrel vaults here, which replicate at the nave crossing the facade, which I think is very important. And you have both the facade here and the section on the interior looking back toward the facade. Very interesting to see that relationship. Next, please. And the plan diagram, one, a diagram showing how you can read the, in a sense, the squares and the relationships between the squares in a kind of Fibonacci progression. And then over here, when you take out the poche, you can produce a series of squares. Now this is a very dangerous drawing, I think, on the left, because it reduces the real character of the space to a kind, this is a kind of modern drawing shown, well, they're all squares. Yeah, they're all squares, but they don't appear as squares. They can be seen as squares, but their intention is not to mark the dots with columns as a modern space would be, a modern rationalist space, but in fact the poche. So this is an example of something that I think there are two different kinds of analysis. One, a proportional geometric analysis to show how the whole thing goes together, which in one sense it does, and in another sense it's very different. Neither of these drawings show to me the compression extension along the nave axis, which makes this space quite unique. And it's that extension and compression which you feel affectively when you're walking in the church that we're now going to see. You have to remember this plan when we look at Redentore and San Giorgio, the two great churches by Palladio. So All of these things refer backward to painting, we see, and they're going to refer forward to Palladio, who comes almost 60 years after this. In between is this figure of Bramante, who to me is one of the most important architects, because he takes this thrust from a transcendental metaphysic to an immanent metaphysic that you see in the movement from Brunelleschi to Alberti, and from the painting of the 13th and 14th centuries to the painting of the 15th century, and he brings it to what I call a degree zero. That degree zero is the moment where the inflection of the poche becomes equal to the inflection of the space. And then, in a sense, all hell breaks loose with Serlio, Palladio, Borromini, Rinaldi, etc. So there is that moment, and I think it's important. We'll look at that next week. What I want to do now, we'll go next door and look at the drawings. Here you go, Neil.